All right, so if you're partially or completely compensated by RVUs, could you stand up? While I get my slideshow going here. And then if you're only compensated by RVUs with no other metrics, sit down. Okay, so now if you're also compensated by a quality metric, sit down. All right, we got a few left. Okay, everyone else can sit down. That was just to wake you up. Don't worry. Who's in private practice and doesn't get compensated by RVUs? Okay, very good. I'm good. I'm trying to speak to some of those concerns a little bit with my talk as well. It's the first time we're doing this panel, so in your evaluation forms, please fill out the comments section. I know it's easy to just click the little buttons and not fill it out, but we hope to provide this at the next Congress if it's well received, and we would certainly modulate our talk to the sort of the needs of what you guys think we should talk about or what we haven't talked about. So the information will be very important. We also have a new manuscript out. Linda, you have it there. So we just put this together. It's available by PDF. You can link it. You can download it from the college's website. It's got a lot of stuff in it. Some of what we've talked about today, some of the slides that I'm going to show are actual graphs from the manuscript. Okay? All right. I'm going to try to run two slides at the same time. Okay, so I have a few disclosures again, nothing really to do with this topic. Well, actually, maybe a little bit to do with it. So let's talk about sort of different practices. I'm going to try and give you an idea of some of the nuances around what you should know about how your RVUs are valued and how your worth is valued beyond just a chart that says you get 10 RVUs for a gallbladder. Okay, so how can you become more knowledgeable about how these compensation agreements are being built nowadays? We're a bit of a disadvantage in a lot of the areas, and I'm sure the reason why you're all here is there's a lot of pressure and there's a lot of angst and a lot of anxiety about how you're being told what you're worth, and it's a little bit unfair because you don't have the data at your fingertips. So if you're in a private practice, you are largely based, you're looking at your ins and outs, essentially, so your collections are very important. In the future, your MIPS incentives, whether you get penalized or incentivized, will be very important for a private practice. You're probably already working on call coverage or covering for a strategic service line that the hospital needs, and so a lot of private practices now realizing that they have so much regulatory burden and so many issues with their EMR and other things they have to do that they're finding that the way to make ends meet are call coverage, trauma coverage, other things like that. Or medical directorships. You're going to run the utilization review committee. You're going to help run the robotics committee. And so that's kind of probably the issues that you're facing as a private practice. Happy to have some feedback. I've been employed my whole career, so I have as good a sense of what your pressures are. If you're employed, you're largely going to have a base compensation with some tiered level, and we'll go through some of those tiers of what's happening in the marketplace now. Whether those are just purely an RVU metric, how those things are measured are important, what you're metriced against is important. Are you being measured for your quality? Are you paid by rank? Are you paid by how long you've been around? Are you paid by the new patients that you grow into the system? There's a lot of innovative ways that people are being metriced, which may be something you're interested in if you don't have that currently. Now, don't throw the rotten vegetables at me, but this is why we're all frustrated. So you can see that the blue line represents the Medicare conversion factor, and the other speakers have alluded to it. It's really been flat. It's been around $35 to $35 for a long time, while the cost of living and the cost of running a medical practice and everything you can imagine has gone up. So there's a disconnect here. So why is that? Well, it's a fixed pie. So the government allocates the budget for Medicare and the physician side of Medicare. And the amount of RVUs in there is expanding. We're doing more visits. We're doing more codes. We've invented more things. And so that's made this conversion factor flat. And so wherever we create a new code that creates new value for patients, I'll give you one example. There's a code for transitioning when a patient is discharged from the hospital. You can now build transitional care management, and you can build, because you're mostly from primary care doctors, you transition that patient back to the office. Well, that code was billed 500,000 times last year, and 2 years ago it didn't exist. So those are a whole bunch of more RVUs that come in here that are keeping that conversion factor flat. And we can talk a whole hour about that, but we'll go onward. So these are some of the data points I want to go through for this talk throughout the next 15 minutes or so. So what is a dollar per RVU contract? How do you get that? Who gets that number? Is it $35? Well, no. Thankfully, it's not. If you're getting $35 per RVU, that's terrible. It's higher than that. It should be higher than that. I'll show you some resources. What are the sources you get? Where they hand you a one-page contract, and you don't know where it comes from. You need to know where it comes from. You need to know how that data is accrued. You need to know how your RVUs are accrued. Okay, we'll talk a little bit about that. Modifiers we touched on, we can expand a little bit as well. If you're in private practice, you're trying to negotiate contracts, so you're trying to get a higher rate than $35 per RVU, right? You want to go out and negotiate with the payers. And if you have to go to the ER and cover a worse payer mix, you're going to negotiate call pay or something else. But you better know what your cost per RVU is if you're in private practice. So you should definitely generate, if your cost per RVU is $40, well, you're losing money on every single Medicare patient that comes in your door, right? So you got a question, you got problems. And these are things that are forcing people to reevaluate their practice and become employed. Now, I met with a couple of my residents that graduated years ago, and they're now running these big practice groups. So then the other model is there's 100 surgeons in Seattle that are going to hire you. Are you employed or are you in private practice? You're probably employed because they're going to use their heavy to negotiate good rates. They're going to take care of your EMR. And so you're going to get an RVU contract from that group, right, even though it's a private practice. So that this whole concept of an RVU metric is very important for your future. So we saw a few of the common, just why the work RVU. You heard that from the first talk from Dr. Lieberman, and the work RVU is the purest number for what you're doing as a surgeon. If you get paid on total, does anyone get paid on total RVUs right now? Not anymore. So my shop about 15 years ago, if you get paid by total RVUs, don't tell them that you're getting probably a pretty good deal. So, but I think they've gotten smart because it's a little bit richer, probably not an accurate red measure. But here's some of the values. You can get some of this data. The AMA sells we have a database, the RUC database. As a RUC member, I have a pretty rigorous database. Realize these numbers just don't come out of thin air. They're related. They're very rigorously put, documented into exactly what you're doing, how much time it takes, how many gauze you use in the office to change the dressing, a staple remover's in there, everything you can imagine is in there. And so when we're told by or asked by various constituents, well, why don't you get more value for whatever? Why don't you get a robotic hernia code? The expectation is that we're going to get 60,000 RVUs for it. Well, it's a relative system. It's never going to be much different. And Dr. Selzer told you time and intensity. So just briefly, if you wanted a robotic inguinal hernia code, is the time longer? Is it more intense or less intense? So if you explain to them that you got your shoes kicked off and you're not even scrubbed and you're sitting down, it's more comfortable, you're going to get less value for that code than the laparoscopic code. It's just not going to out of thin air be this great code. It's just the system works. So, most of your contracts are going to use the work RVU versus the total RVU as the better metric. So you're going to be told you're paid based on your work RVU. Okay, so how do they get that number? Well, there are various organizations that provide compensation survey data. And if you don't have access to one of these, you probably should invest in one just to see how it's built. So there's MGMA, AAMC, and if you graph them, there's about 13 of them. Some are better than others. Some are richer than others per RVU. So for general surgery now, the range I found was anywhere between $45 and $65 per RVU. Now, is that total compensation? Is that factor in your benefits? There's all little nuances in it you have to be smart about. But you should get one. You can buy the MGME data. It's expensive. But if you haven't looked at it, you should either get a copy from your physician services group or you should buy it and just to get an idea of what's all in there. Right. There's a tremendous number of tables in there that are worth looking at for sure. And this just shows you as well that there's this decoupling happening between the conversion factor and what you're being paid. If you look at MGMA over the years, you will see that in general the dollar per RVU is going up. And in some senses, the RVUs to get that dollar are actually flat. They're not always going up. So that's encouraging. So if you looked at sort of the worth of a surgeon over the last 5 or 10 years in MGMA, it's going up. And so it's becoming more and more decoupled from that 35 number. And it may not even matter in some situations, right? So if I work in a hospital that doesn't have a great payer mix, so I might not. It doesn't maybe matter if they even get paid sometimes, as long as I get the RVU credit. And I'll show you why they pay us for that. Here's a file right out of the MGMA book. It's in the document that we talked about. And if you look at that, so this is one table. Now, there's like 20 or 30 tables in there. So there's total compensation. There's academic center. There's hospital loan practice in there. There's 67% billable clinical time tables. I mean, there's a tremendous differences in there. So which table are they using for you? Do you know? If you look at this number carefully, it says total compensation. Well, your people might say, well, that includes your benefits. Well, if you look at the little asterisk there, it says total compensation represents some of the salary, bonus, call pay, research, and other, but not the benefits. So when you did they count your benefits in your RVU and they subtract it out, or is this purely what you're getting per RVU? So you've got to know that stuff. Will they always show it to you? Maybe not. But you got to fight for this sort of information because it's critical to understanding where your value is. Trying to run my notes section over here. Okay. So then, you know, do you want to have more than one survey? Most people recommend, and we're going to talk about fair market value in a couple of slides, more than one survey. You probably want two surveys at least. And do you get to pick them? Because if you do, I can tell you which ones are better than others per dollar, because they definitely vary. What if one is for general surgery only has like 1,000 people surveyed in it, and the other one has 100? Well, you should weight it, right? I did a faculty practice plan, and we had my breast surgeon, and I said, well, and I was kind of on the rooting for the physician side, so I was negotiating with the system, so I wanted everyone's salaries to be good. Well, it turned out that there was differences between the general surgeon and the oncologic surgeon and the breast surgeon. And the best one was the oncologic surgeon. And in the breast surgeon surveys that we did, there weren't that many. The numbers weren't high enough. So we said, well, these isn't valid. There's only 30 people in this one. There's 400 in this one. We want to use this one. And they said, that makes sense. So we negotiated that, and we used the better survey data that we felt was more accurate. And when we had one, we did for my G1 oncology colleagues, I helped them, and they wanted to use two surveys. Well, one was very robust, and one was not very didn't have enough numbers. So we weighted it, and it helped. You know, it helped the salary, helped the work RVU dollar figure, and it was more accurate data. So it's worth getting into the weeds here. And then we said, well, what about if you're in the median? So if you take the median salary divided by the median RVU, and you get $60. Well, what if I'm in the 75th? Do I want the 75th salary divided by the 75th RVUs? Maybe. Well, it's not necessarily linear. So we went back and forth on that. Sometimes you would say, okay, when I'm in the 75th, your RVU could go down or up. It just doesn't, it depends on the survey data in there. So it's not typically linear. You might think it would be, but it's not. So in general, we've gone back to just a median value because it doesn't vary that much. But for your own specialty, you might look at that and say, I'm a 90% guy. I want to know, what are the 90% guys doing across the country? And if that number is higher than what you're getting, I want that. Right, so you can dig into the data a little more carefully when you're trying to do your negotiation, if they'll allow you to see it, right? So do you want a blended or a weighted? How robust is the data set? Are there thousands in there? Are there 50 in there? And maybe you want to switch to a different company. Who inputs your codes? How do you do your value? Are you allowed to put in your own RVU value? Is it audited? Does your biller do it? Do you just rely on someone else to do it? You shouldn't rely on someone else to do it. That's number one. You should take a coding course. You should bill appropriately, but you should probably do it yourself or check up on it very often. All right? Who audits it? What if there's a back-end analysis and it was denied because of your documentation? Do your RVUs get taken out? All right? I mean, if you're doing an indigent patient, do you get credit for your RVUs even though there's no payment? You got to know the stuff. So you should, you know, really get deep into the weeds of your RVU report every month and see what's going in there. I had a denial for a code that they said kick back, and they took the RVUs out, and so I had to go back and I saw it. I said, no, that's not right. Come on, let me meet with you and reset them. So who will accrue the data is critical. So you know, you should submit your own charges. Now, if you're getting audited and you're someone a little rich on like thinking that you're worth a lot more codes, you got to be careful. Obviously, we advocate for correct coding. So learning about how to maximize your coding but also do it appropriately is something you need to think about. What about co-surgery or assistant at surgery? How are these getting valued? I do a lot of spine exposures for the neurosurgeons who are in private practice. So I put my code in the system, and it gets a full RVU value, even though I know it's going to get reduced when the payment comes back. So I told him up front, I said, listen, this is going to get paid less. I said, but I'm the only one in town that does it, and you want the neurosurgeons, right? And they said, oh, yeah, well, it's okay. You know, so for a product line, that's okay for fair market value. So I get full credit for that. It's fine with me, right? Unlisted codes, as we heard from Dr. Salzer, you have to sort of come up with a crosswalk. And so if your billers are not, and you know, your biller, you should also work with your billers to help you get reimbursed for those things. So if you were part of the early laparoscopic incisional hernia, you realize that we didn't get a value for a while. We waited a while. So we go way back. When we valued laparoscopic inguinal hernia, and I wasn't at the table at that time, so I can't claim the disgrace that it's lower, but we valued that code too soon. So we brought laparoscopic inguinal hernia. We wanted a code. And when we surveyed everybody, they were in their mind thinking of the easiest, direct hernia, male, no problem. The times were 60 minutes. The times for the open were 70 minutes, so it was less. So when we came to them and said, the times are less, and they said, well, is it more intense then? And someone at the table pulled up the New York Times ad that said, faster home, easier, no pain, no, everything's easier. And they went, man, we see this. And so that's why that code got less value, not realizing that 5 years later, we would be doing incarcerated and all these horrible big cases, and we should have waited and not valued that code right away, right? So we did that for the incisional code. And my point being is that a lot of us got really good at billing unlisted codes for laparoscopic incisional hernia. So if you were part of that era for about 10 years, we were getting paid using the unlisted code doing laparoscopic incisional hernia, and frankly, we were getting paid pretty good. But then we were forced to take the data, which now had a good history, and value the code, and that's when we got the values for that code. So there is good precedent with your payers, but it takes a little work. You have to sort of construct a letter, construct these pseudocodes, and crosswalk them, and get paid. So you should try to work through that. So I do a lot of laparoscopic pancreas and gastric and liver, and there's no codes for that stuff. But we crosswalk them. We negotiate with the payer a similar payment, and I get RVU value that crosses over similar to the open code. But if you don't do that, the unlisted codes, you're going to get zero RVU credit for that. So you got to do the work to get in there. It's a lot of work to get that done. What about scenarios where, you know, there's other scenarios that you were starting to see out there that are part of, should you get, I'll just give you the example. You know, you're starting a robotic Whipple program, and you've mandated at your hospital that two surgeons have to be there because you're both on your learning curve. And so will one surgeon get an assist fee and one surgeon get the full fee? Will one surgeon get the full RVU? Will one surgeon get the other? This is a product line that the hospital wants. If you're looking for quality outcomes, this is something that you could say, well, maybe we should consider full RVU credit for both of us until we get up to speed, and then we'll separate and we'll do it. It's not illegal. If you're looking at strategic service lines that are not duplicated anyway. Now, if there's another group, there's two groups doing that, and they pay one but not the other, that's a big problem. But there are unique circumstances where if your outcome is based or on a service line is being developed, that there may be some room for you to sort of say, my worth is more than just the RVU from this one code. Okay. So then you got to throw in the whole Stark thing and the fair market value, because if you're employed with a system, now you're in this arena. If you're employed by a big bunch of doctors, you don't have this problem. This is where a system is owned, right? A hospital system is owned. And these are the rules. You know, CMS regulation, this comes from the Stark Law from way back that got revised. So it's Stark 3 is the current version. And it states that a hospital may pay you a fair market salary as an employee or for specific services rendered as an independent contractor, call pay, for example. The hospital may not offer you monies to, for example, give you below market rent or cover your overhead or influence your referral decisions. That's key. They can't influence. So they couldn't say, I'm giving you full RVU, but the other group I'm not. That's a problem. They're looking at the services you perform, the method of compensation, and it has to be on a fair market value. Hence, they've embraced the RVU, and they've embraced MGMA, and they use these other survey groups, right, which can be a black box. So you have to be smart about, well, where did your fair market survey come from? Well, we sent it off to our fair market value committee, and they looked at it, and they said, this is what you're worth. Well, I'm looking at all this other data, and I'm thinking it's this. And it depends. If it's a big group, you may or may not have much leverage, depending on how important you are, how critical you are to the area. What's thrown in here a little bit is the fair market value can be influenced by critical need for a specialty. So we lost both of our cardiac surgeons, no cardiac surgeons in the whole town. Those guys are going to get a good deal because the fair market value for them just went up. because there's a critical shortage. So if you're in that situation, you know, a lot of my residents who graduated who want to go to a rural area, they're getting a pretty good deal. They're getting employed, and there's a critical need for them. So the fair market is higher. The fair market is actually higher in a scarce area than in a big city like Boston. There's plenty of surgeons around here, right? So they're not going to be able to say, well, there's a shortage of doctors in this area. So these are little twists that can influence fair market value. So if you're talking about an RVU from 50 to 55 or 50 to 60, and you say, listen, you know, I'm all you got, I want 60, you probably have a case. Follow me? Okay. All right. In private practice, and again, I've been employed my whole career, but you're what I'm hearing in some of the communities that we're talking about is you're really trying to negotiate with commercial payers, and because you're a one- or two-man group, you're really at a disadvantage, and it's unfortunate because the private guys are really struggling, I think, in a lot of areas. They're trying to look for, so they have increasing regulatory burden, they have higher EMR costs to maintain them, and yet they can't, in some states, you can't even negotiate an out-of-network rate. You're trying to make your ER call coverage, you know, compensate you for patients that can't pay. And so your knowledge of your practice costs is going to be critical. If you can't cover your RVUs with a certain revenue stream, you're going to be out of business. And the last bullet point here is if you're negotiating for administrative add-ons, so if you're an employee, whether you're an employee or whether you're a prior practice and they ask you to be the chief of the medical staff or the head of the UR committee or the head of the neurorobotics committee, you should get an hourly rate. Most of these are on a timesheet. The current hourly rate for general surgeons, you can extrapolate it out of some of those survey data. And it's anywhere from $200 to $250 an hour in general, and you can go higher or lower. But you can take an MGMA survey, divide it by 50 hours a week, and come up with a number. So you can pull that right out of a survey data. And those should be add-ons. So not to keep it going, but you're going to see the decoupling continue to happen. And while the RVUs are going to be important, the conversion factor may not be as much important. And there's reasons for that. And I'm going to hit that at the very end here. I'm getting to the end of my... let you guys have some time to talk. So this is what's called the cake model, which is made famous by Dr. Mabry, just in our... I think we're getting hungry towards the end while we were making this paper. But if there's uncoupling occurring, well, then how are we going to get paid? So you'll have a base salary, particularly if you're starting out. If you're going to a new area where you're starting, you got to have a floor. You got to have protection. So the young people out here, if you're getting your first contract, two things for you guys. Make sure you have a base floor that you're happy with, and hopefully it's 3 years, not one. 3 years is probably the standard, maybe two, three. And make sure there's RVUs available for you to capture. Are you joining a community of three doctors that are each doing 10,000 RVUs and they really need help? Or are you joining a group where one guy's retiring and he's going to give you all his RVUs? Or are you joining a group and you're supposed to go to a satellite and start over? That's going to be a little more tricky, right? So you got to know where your RVU is going to come from. It'd be very important to understand that. You can't walk into your job and go, all right, I'm ready to work as hard as I can. They go, well, I have no patients yet. You got to go play nice with the GI guys or something, you know? That's going to be harder for you, right? So you'll have a base and you'll have productivity based after that. And then you'll have a historical productivity. So I have a historical productivity. So I'm essentially all productivity based, but I get 90% of that front because I have a history of the last 3 years. So they take my last 3 years of the data and give me 90% of that going forward. And as long as I hit that, I get a bonus on top of it. And then you might have other metrics for quality outcomes. You might have call pay. You might have metrics for educational. So I pay my faculty an educational RVU, whether they show up at faculty meetings, whether they show up at interviews for applicants, whether they give mock orals, and they get points for all those sort of things. You might get points for just having good civic responsibility. Some contracts are given like 1 or 2% for, do you do your charts on time, or do you do your evaluations on time? And that sort of thing should be an easy piece of the pie to get. And so you'll see these layer cakes being built now. And here's an example of like the most, this is also from our manuscript. You can see that what the trends have been. So if you look at that table, you can see everything's been RVU-based going back to 2013. So of your contract, what was the breakdown? And if you look at it, you'll see that net collections has become less of an issue. It's up to 10% from 20 in the 20s. And the quality part of it's going up. So systems are realizing that if you have good quality, you're probably saving them money in aggregate, right? So if you have a lower length of stay, good outcomes, no leaks, no infections, yada yada, you're worth more, right? So if you know your metrics, that's very important. We're not going to get into quality metrics, but know your metrics. You know, every Every time I meet a hernia surgeon, I ask them what the recurrence rate is, and they say, nothing. I never see a recurrence. Then I ask them, do you follow your patients for 2 years? And they say, no, I see them once, and that's it. Well, you have no idea what your recurrence rate is, so no idea. Now, Blue Cross knows, for sure they know, okay? So if you don't think the payers know what your readmission rate is and your infection rate is, and your, they know all that stuff, and I could go into that. You know, I've seen it. So big data has really exposed, you know, so if you think you're an above-average doctor, you better be sure, okay? Because if we had to raise our hand, we'd all be above-average, right? That's why we're here at the college, clearly. And then this is a lot, I'm getting towards the end, but this is really important, and people, this is why you could potentially get $60 per RVU. So if you look at the general surgery metric there, you know, and there's, you know, big centers want to build a wall between what you make in your practice and what you make for the hospital and the OR and ordering CAT scans and tests and so forth. But general surgeons create about $2 million of revenue for their system. And so when you say, listen, I want $54 an RVU, not $50, and that gives you maybe $50,000 more, they're like, sure. I mean, think about it, right? If you're a competent surgeon who works hard, who has good outcomes, and you're like a, you know, you're one of the franchise players at your place, knowing this information in your back pocket, now you can't say it out loud because I'll say, whoa, 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 you know, that's a violation. But you said, listen, guys, this is what I need. And, you know, you can negotiate knowing this information, and you can get other things too. So, you know, it might enable you to say, like, I realize that there's a violation if I, you know, you're not going to give me more referrals or more compensation. But at the same time, you might want a dedicated unit for your patients. So we organized a GI unit just for our patients, post Whipple and liver and so forth. And we handpicked our nurses that we wanted, and they let us do that. And they gave us resources to build our ERAS protocols and resources to build a center of excellence. So all these sort of add-on things that you might want, you could leverage for knowing what your worth is. So right, if you only operate in one hospital, you're employed there, you're the busiest guy. And you say, listen, I want to develop some stuff. This is what I'm thinking about. And if it also parallels with their need to create a center of excellence, increase their quality, they're going to be all about it. So just keep that in your back pocket as you try to make, because it may be that you won't get more RVU value, but you'll make your life a lot better if you've got resources that help streamline your patient care. All right? Don't underestimate that. It can make your life a lot easier. So just to summarize, you know, why are RVUs so important? They are definitely linked to your employment model. These compensation surveys and fair market values, they're really a black box, and there's some concern, and there's actually some talk within the college that we should form our own survey metric so that you could, as a fellow, you could say, what do you think my fair market value is? And we could say, well, based on 10,000 surveys from all of our surgeons, you know, here's what we think it is for the middle of Ohio. That would be valuable, I think, to the fellows, and there's some talk about that, because I don't trust any of these other places, honestly. And the other thing that I'm cautious of is I know a few practices that are very high-earning private practices. Well, they don't report their data, so we don't have the high-end in the data sources a lot of times. A lot of times these data sources will call a big center like Hopkins or whatever and say, listen, if you send us all your comp data, we'll give you access to the files for free. And so they're not getting the smaller groups, so the data may not be as accurate as we'd like it to be. And so I think that we could do our fellows justice in providing an MGMA from the College of Surgeons, if you will. Right. This is a take-home message. You know, stay in the conversation. You know, there's a lot of pressure coming after proceduralists. A lot of people think that we don't do the work we think we do. A lot of people think that we've given up. Let me go back one second. Can I go back with this? Let's see. Okay. Oh, no. It's on the next slide. You know, a lot of people think we don't do the work we're paid for. They don't think we round on our patients. They think the hospitalist takes over and takes care of everybody post-op. Now, you might have a hospitalist, but they're not doing the post-op care. So we have to stay in the conversation. You know, there's a model that the anesthesiologists want to be the perioperativists and just take care of it for us. So as soon as you go up there and say, call pharmacy for the TPN and call the antibiotic committee to tell me what to give them and call the, you know, best practices lab line. You're giving up all that stuff. You got to keep all that stuff, right? Because you're paid for that in the global payment. So just keep that in mind. It's the more you give away, the harder it's going to be for you, okay? All right, there you go. Thank you.
Ooh, closing the house down. So we have some time for questions. If you want to come up to the microphone, we do have some of the employed surgeon handbooks out at the table outside, and they're also available downstairs at the ACS advocacy booth if those of you want to pick up one and not download it. Anyone have any questions? Sir?
David Reeve Denerma, colorectal surgeon in New York. Excellent panel, really informative. We've seen a trend in the New York area that they're going away from RVU-based compensation to money coming into the door. So we're starting to see a change in that in terms of, again, RVU models are kind of going by the wayside, and they're actually presenting our newer faculty and newer members with
a cash collection model.
With a cash collection model. And as we all know, that model is trending downwards, right? And yeah. No one's making more money with insurance companies. How do you feel about that, and how, as a physician and surgeon, should we be responding?
So that's not happening in other places. In fact, that was the trend 10 years ago, that they couldn't keep people there in some places. So it's going to depend a lot upon what your payer mix. If you're covering an ER, like, you don't know what's coming in there. So you'll have to have like an indigent service agreement, some sort of backup for Medicaid, or you'd have, and then you have to say, well, who's negotiating our contracts? Because you don't know what their rates are going to be for Blue Cross. Your hands are tied. So you got to push back on that one, because you really can't impact on what the collections will be. Right.
Sir?
Hi. Chris Comey, Chair of Surgery at St. Francis in Hartford. So our organization is going through a bit of a struggle with the 51 modifier. You know, one of the speakers talked about the degradation is a, you know, written in stone, 100%, 50%, 50%. Are the MGMA data reflective of that?
Yes. Yeah, so I think that they do reflect correct coding. And so, you know, the reason why that 51 modifier is there, if you look at a code like a colon resection, let's say, you know, built in there is the visit before surgery, the preoperative, we talked about the waiting and scrubbing and the whole operation, and then the 2 or 3 days in the hospital at whatever level visit, and then the 3 or 4 days in the 3 or 4 visits in the office, right? Well, when you do that colon resection, if you take the gallbladder out at the same time, well, you don't see them twice and do 2 HMPs, and you don't see them 7 times in the office, so it's duplicative.
Right.
And so that's why that rule came about, because there's some, you know, economy and scale when you do more than one thing at a time. But in the MGMA and all those surveys, that is accounted for.
Okay.
But having said that, the numbers that I showed up there are how Medicare addresses that. Private payers don't necessarily address all the modifiers exactly the same way. That's how Medicare addresses that. So you might find that a private payer doesn't follow the 50% after the first code. And naturally, that when you start seeing that in shift in payment, that's when you have to, as a major organization, approach the insurers and say, now, wait a second, you're disincentivizing us to take care of all of the problems for this patient at this one time, and you're encouraging us to make them make multiple trips. And this doesn't make any sense for the patient, and this doesn't make any sense for your bottom line either. Let's talk about how to address this effectively for both of us.
Joseph Oliver from Newark. To kind of follow along on that, like the 51 versus the 59, like how does that kind of play in and like into those type of things, and like what is more going to be applicable for a 59 modifier versus the 51 modifier? Because isn't it like a separate incision is now a 59, or like, so?
Yeah, so unfortunately the 51 and the 59 modifiers are treated differently by all payers, so it's hard to predict, and you kind of have to experiment with them when you interact with an individual payer. In general, the 59 modifier, to remind everybody from that slide, suggested a distinct procedure. And the example would be that if you are taking out their gallbladder and you remove a lipoma from their leg during the same surgical procedure, that you get paid separately for them, because typically a lipoma would be a skin opening and closure that would be bundled into the gallbladder if it's on the abdomen. But you're telling him it's on the arm or on the leg, it's in a different location, it deserves to be paid differently. And so you have to work with a seasoned coding team. There are resources as a fellow of the American College of Surgeons to ask coding questions in those particular scenarios. But usually the 51 modifier is used when you're doing a bunch of procedures in the same operative field, and the 59 modifier is used when you're doing procedures in different operative fields.
Sir?
Hi, Eugene Cho from Tacoma, Washington. Don, just to follow up on that, our coders believe that some procedures done at the same time as another procedure, regardless of 51 modifier, are not billable at all. So an umbilical hernia repair done at the same time as a cholecystectomy using the umbilical hernia as an extraction site cannot be billed at all, even if it's a 4-centimeter hernia requiring a component separation and more resources utilized on the part of both the surgeon and the facility. Is that correct? And if so, is there a way to deal with that? An unbilled procedure that is really a separate procedure.
Well, so, I mean, that's the classic example of a slippery slope that we see all the time. So as you can imagine, first of all, in the preamble guidelines for abdominal surgery, for example, when you operate on somebody, opening the abdomen and closing the abdomen is included. So you can't, you're not going to start billing for closure after a colectomy. So, you could imagine that a lot of people have a small umbilical hernia after lap chole, so that could be potentially abused. We can debate whether you should put a mesh in a CDC class 2 wound, i.e. a lap chole. I probably wouldn't. When you're closing a 1 or 2 centimeter defect, yeah, that's closing the incision. It's not separately billable, and I would agree with your coders. If you're talking about a 3 or 4 centimeter and you're doing a bigger operation, I'd be careful. I probably wouldn't do it. I'd probably stage it. But so you can see how you'd probably have to do that in a separate operation, both from a treatment standpoint as well from a reimbursement standpoint.
Right, but the belief that our coders have is we extract the gallbladder over here and then make a completely separate incision. Now they'll bill it. So they're incentivizing. They're saying they're incentivizing us to make additional incisions so that it's a separate
incision. Yeah, I probably wouldn't do that.
We would never do that, but that's what they're,
Right.
You can also consider a 22 modifier if need be for that case.
Jason Chowey from Palm Springs, California. You might have already spoken about this, but I just want to make sure. Has anybody heard about Medicare not paying for facility charges starting 2019? And also, with regards to contribution value, when the hospital wants to renegotiate based on contribution value, how do you take that into consideration when you're renegotiating, especially if you're a subspecialist and you're using OR time?
So I'll address the site of service issue, and that's a potential change coming forward of leveling site of service payment for physicians that are facility employed versus a physician in private practice. So Medicare is saying that you're an office doc and you're seeing a general surgery patient in the office. I don't want to pay for you seeing patients in a facility when you're doing the exact same work, basically. It's a bigger issue than we could probably address here today, but that the basis of that is leveling site of service payment.
And as far as trying to get your hospital data, so I depends if you're able to get it. If you can get your hospital side like contribution margin data, it's hard to get that stuff. But I would say that your best idea is to say I'm trying to just establish a quality improvement outcome. And I think that if I can do this, this, and this, I could decrease length of stay by half a day or something. You come up with an idea and say, and if you can get somebody in decision support, which is where all the data is, say, could I work with someone from decision support to pull out the length of stay for all of my deep flaps or some breast reconstruction? I don't know what your specialty is. And I'd like to work on that. And that's how you might get in to see the data and say, okay, now it's a win-win. I want to do better for the patients. You want to reap the quality benefits, and maybe you get something that way. And grow your capital as someone who is looking to grow the system, not just yourself.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Can you expand more on the educational RVU, how they translate into work, and has there been effective for the other faculty?
Yeah, there's models that go all over the place. So it works for surgeons. It's more of like an add-on. So what we do is we sort of have base requirements for our faculty and say, to get 80% of your stipend, you got to do all these things, which is pretty much let a resident operate, make rounds. That's a pretty low bar. But to get the other 20%, you got to do whatever I tell them to do that year, all right? And so what we're doing now, and I don't want to hold back anyone's stipend, so I really don't, but but what I'll do is every year I'll have like a high-stakes metric. So this year, for example, we had you got to turn in all your evaluations within 30 days, 80% within 30 days, or you lose your entire 20% bonus. And everyone was 100% for one guy. Except for one guy, there's always one guy. And saved a little money and rolled that over to the residence fund for travel to things like this. So so I'm not sure the high stakes semesters can be next year, but so that's been helpful for me as a program director to sort of keep people in line. But otherwise, people kind of get, you know, get what they, if they do the right thing, they get it.
A quick follow-up question. Does have residence in your cases change your, the way you bill for RVUs or the whole work?
No, you mean the coding's the same. Okay. Yeah. Unless you have a PA and a resident. So be careful if you're, if you have a PA and you're billing for the PA and you got a resident, you can get to be wearing an orange suit if you're not careful.
John McConaughey, Newton, Kansas. Thank you for an excellent presentation. It's very useful, I think, to all the members. Follow-ups on the decision for surgery modifier. We've gone around and around in our coding audits of, you see the GI bleed patient, you're evaluating their current medications, anticoagulation, reversal, transfusion, all of these factors, and they say, no, it was the day that you did the scope, which of course you did it that day. It needed to be done. Are there good resources from the college that you would put forth to say, this is to show them and educate them that this is the standard of care and reimbursable? And then the other was, you'd mentioned some other good data sets and which data sets we should focus on. Other than just MGMA, are there ones that you recommend that help general surgeons to leverage the value of what we're doing?
So we are hearing from various fellows that the 57 modifier is getting some pushback. So send an email to us on the, you know, because we're going to fight for that. We've heard that from three or four different areas of the country that there's been some pushback, and it's, the guidelines are clear that that's reimbursable. So we're just pointing in the right direction. You know, MGMA is a pretty good one to start with. The smaller ones like Merritt Hawkins tends to be on the higher side. Sullivan Cotter's on the lower side. I don't know about AMC or AMGA. They tend to be
double AMC is low.
Lower side. So I would start with MGMA if I was you.
I think in terms of the documentation too, it's remember that the individuals that are doing this, if you're relying on someone coding or auditing the chart, looking for this, they're looking for documentation of that decision for surgery. So if you have a time, you have a templated H&P with not much conversation in there that what happened between the screening colonoscopy or the polypectomy that made you have to decide to escalate care to the level of you're taking this patient to surgery or back for an endoscopic procedure to control bleeding or whatever the procedure is, you need to document as much as possible.
Yeah, Warren Dorlag from Colorado. I have a little bit of a complex question, maybe. We've got a standard to do an ERCP followed by a laparoscopic cholecystectomy in the same anesthesia if it's a simple stone identified preoperatively and the ERCP goes uneventfully. Then we'll just roll the patient into the operating room and take out their gallbladder. If the ERCP is done by the gastroenterologist, we don't have an issue. If the ERCP is done by one of our surgical complex endoscopy trained fellows who has literally five times the experience as our gastroenterologist, they won't pay for his services because he is a member of our group.
Same, right?
Yeah, so all yours, Don.
Yeah, unfortunately, one of the major issues when you are trying to do teams of surgeons or co-surgeons during the same anesthesia or the same interval of service is they will not recognize two people within the same designated specialty as individual providers, so you're not going to get a team of surgeons approach. The most you might get is that person gets an assistant fee if one person charges for both of them. That might be the more effective way to approach that. But the specialty designation is something that is that everybody designates through Medicare when they sign up for Medicare. And so for an example that I commonly give is if you have a patient who has a complex hernia and needs their colostomy taken down, now a general surgeon can do all of that, or a colorectal surgeon could bill for the colostomy takedown and the general surgeon could try to bill separately for a hernia repair. Not all insurers will pay for it, but having two designated different specialties during the same procedure will give you a better likelihood of a better outcome from a billing standpoint.
So you're going to designate your fellow as a surgical oncologist.
So he's got complex endoscopy, and we have the same problem with our surgical oncologist. We have a surgical oncologist in our group as well. And so...
I'm not certain complex endoscopy is a recognized specialty designation in Medicare.
Doesn't work for endoscopy, but works for surgery. So if you do like an esophagectomy, I do it with the thoracic guy. The two of us are different specialty designations. We're fine. But it just doesn't apply in endoscopy.
I think it's 4 o'clock, so we have to close up. But we'll have a few folks up here to answer some questions unless someone's coming in. And thanks, everyone, for coming.